Welcome back to the Thermodiet Podcast. I'm your host, Jaden Miller. And today I have on the podcast, Nicholas Simpson. So I've had Nicholas on a couple of times and I always love it whenever he jumps on the podcast. The man is an absolute genius. And he talks about, in this episode, different ways that we can increase exercise capacity and our ability to handle more work over time. So we go through everything from supplements to nutrition, just to different kinds of training strategies and things like that. So I'm super excited for y'all to be able to listen to this one. So let's dive in. Nicholas, thank you for being back on here today. How are you doing?
My pleasure. Thank you. Things are good. The weather's heated up here lately, so we don't really get much of a summer. And then as I was saying, like the restrictions have started to ease up, so we're able to start doing more sessions outside, and we have a couple of track groups going. That's nice.
Heck yeah. So for the listeners who might not know who Nicholas Simpson is, do you mind kind of giving them just a brief background?
Yeah, so I've been in SNC for a little over a decade now. A lot of that time I spent with the Canadian Sport Institute here, mostly training our Canadian speed skaters. And that was everyone from development to Olympic level. And I think through kind of 2.5 Olympic cycles with that, also worked with the Farsi swimmers at the university here. And then just in the last little while on the private side and you know, my own background, like more of a meathead. So that had involved powerlifting and weightlifting and a little bit of bodybuilding in the past. And I've sort of covered the spectrum focusing on that to more like movement-based training and movement efficiency and not really doing much lifting at all. And now finding more of a happy middle ground that, is always just a mishmash of everything.
Heck yeah, that's awesome. And for those of you listening, his beard's hiding it, but he's got some thick traps and a giant neck too. He's not small for sure. Yeah. But awesome. So today I wanted to talk a little bit about some different strategies that we could use to increase exercise capacity. So could you kind of give us a brief overview of like what exercise capacity is and why we would want to increase it?
Yeah, I mean, so what most people think of is just the very simple, the ability to do work and to do more work, either without stopping, without resting, or maybe you are still resting, but just within a given session, you're able to accumulate more total volume of whatever it is that you're working on. And there's a, you know, as far as why you would want to do that, you know, just to get things progressing faster, you can only increase intensity so much. And so at some point you just need to do more of, I guess, more moderate loads or more moderate efforts. And especially for something like BJJ or anything with a technical component, which I would say is pretty much everything, practice makes perfect. So the more that you can get in and be mindful about, typically the quicker and better results you're gonna get. Mm-hmm.
So you would say increasing frequency is gonna be a good strategy for that?
Yeah, so that's an easy one. So frequency in terms of the amount of sessions per week, we're probably talking about there, but you could look at that from a bodybuilding side, but or just any kind of session or workout, but instead of training 3 times a week and then just absolutely crushing yourself in those sessions where it takes more time to recover from and you're doing more damage. Just doing less volume, but per session and 4, 5, 6 times a week. I'd say that's probably a much friendlier way to start to up the volume and increase your capacity.
Definitely.
I thought, like, just to, for the listeners as well, one of the things we were going to get into this chat is specifically, like, what our approaches to increase capacity in a quote unquote, like, pro-metabolic or bioenergetic way, and what exactly that means. And, you know, I would say that means doing things, it entails doing things in the least stressful way possible. And as far as what stressful means, I'd say, like, the more scarcity your body experiences, and scarcity in terms of energy levels, I guess, relative to the demands you're putting on it, that is what is going to increase the stress of, you know, a single session or the work of however many accumulated sessions that you have in a week. And that's really, like, that's the way most people go about building their capacity or endurance, is actually trying to, like, push more and more scarcity onto their system. Like, I'm going to make my body adapt harder to do more by eating less and doing more work and taking less rest, doing longer sessions, doing more sessions, just that overall, like, more work is better approach. And, you know, if you've been through a few cycles of that, you realize, like, that's typically the road to burnout, which is all the same things we talk about with, you know, the way most people eat and diet versus trying to follow, like, a more pro-metabolic diet and just in supporting your metabolism that way. And then, you know, Ray Pete, one of his newsletters came out the other day, and I'll paraphrase him here, but he said, he had a good quote there, that our goal should be to continually improve conditions rather than reducing our needs to match poor conditions. And so, again, that's the latter there is how I would say most people go about their capacity or endurance training, is creating poor conditions for the body. So you're doing more on less and then forcing your body to adapt to that stress. You know, that will improve your ability to tolerate those conditions, but at a cost. And that cost is going to be, like, both your power in those activities and just your, like, energy and abilities in everyday life. So I'd say that typical approach is not the one that you want to go about. And if I was thinking about this, and I would say there's sort of three broad ways that you can attack training for endurance or capacity. And the first one is the one that we were just discussing, but essentially you can improve your endurance and capacity by reducing your energy output, or that would basically be reducing your power. So an example of that would be if you have a fast car, or you're starting with a fast car, you have a certain amount of fuel in the tank and you want it to last longer, you could have a behavioral adaptation for driving it that reduces your power. You could just say, I'm going to drive slower, I'm going to accelerate slow. Those things are going to reduce your power, but you'll be more fuel efficient. You'll get further on that. Not necessarily a good strategy if you're racing. The other thing would be a structural adaptation, where you say, okay, my V8 is is burning a lot of gas, and then you swap that out for a V6, and then you swap that out for a V4. So you are building your endurance, making your car go further, but at the expense of power. And that's, again, that's really what most people's approach is, whether they realize it or not. You could sort of classify a lot of endurance training as more power reduction training. And if you look at, you know, a lot of people who have been training for marathons for a while and ask them to do a vertical jump, you get like a single digit in terms of the number of inches they're coming off the ground. So the question then, and that would be, again, fall into that more anti-metabolic approach, because those adaptations, for the most part, they're not just limited to the muscles that you're training, but you're slowing down your entire system in that process. It doesn't just sense that energy scarcity in the muscles that you're running with or biking with or rowing with or whatever. It's a whole systemic energy deficit. And so it's going to start to slow every process down in the body so that it can spend less energy and save what energy it has for those tasks. And, you know, especially if your energy intake is low, and especially in women, that's where you get into the formerly called the female athlete triad, but now more often referred to as REDS or Red S, but the relative energy deficiency in sport. And it's broader in that context and applied to men and women, but basically the effects that having a negative energy balance over time has on your system. And they're broad in terms of the reproductive and endocrine and immune effects. So that was approach number one, was to increasing endurance and capacity, was reducing your energy output or reducing your power output. Typically, I'd say the way we want to avoid. The second strategy you can use is to increase your energy efficiency. So basically just making sure as much of the energy you're spending as possible goes into doing what you want to do. You know, in the automotive analogy, you'd say that means not having any excess weight in the car. For the car, it's aerodynamic, your tires aren't bald, it's oiled up. For the person, it's like, you know, excess weight can be one thing, but also technique for everything. Like the less efficient your technique is, by definition, the more energy you're spending. And so the more you're practicing that and doing that, your energy expenditure is going to be way greater than someone else's whose technique is awesome. So especially for the people starting out in any event or any sport, they should really spend as much time as possible learning and drilling the proper techniques in a way where they're not killing themselves, with lots of rest. And that rest is probably going to help them stay focused and execute things correctly relative to just kind of mindless drilling. But that's one you should hit early on, and really only after it depends on like if you have time frames for competitions. There's always a lot of ifs, ands, or buts. But if you're not in a rush, like you should always address efficiency before you worry about building capacity in other ways. And what was it? On that note, where are we? Energy efficiency. Technique. Well, I lost my train of thought.
Oh. So by increasing the efficacy of the technique, you would technically be using, like, you would be decreasing the amount of energy output that you're giving in that, right?
Yeah.
What are some of the limiting factors that we need to take into consideration whenever we're thinking about increasing our capacity? So for instance, like the lactic acid threshold, how would we, in a metabolically friendly way, look to increase our ability to handle the amount of lactic acid and increase our ability to get rid of that as much as possible?
Yeah. So there's a few factors there. So that type of training, like where you deliberately push yourselves into those lactic acid zones, tends to be some of the most stressful. So strategy one, again, is what strategies can you use to avoid that stress? And one of those, again, make sure you're not wasting any energy. So that comes down to good technique. You can use more rest when appropriate. And another one is probably a little bit more controversial in the pro metabolic world, but increasing your aerobic capacity. But if you have a good aerobic system, good ventilation, good like blood vessel and blood supply to the muscles, the more energy you have coming into those muscles aerobically, the less time you'll need to, the less you're likely to get into that lactic acid zone, and the quicker you'll be able to clear that when you do accumulate it. The third strategy would be specifically like exposing yourself to a lot of that training so that your body upregulates the enzymes like lactate dehydrogenase specifically to clear lactate. That's probably would be my least favorite way to go about thing, because that sort of, again, it falls into kind of the middle training zone. And I would say practically the way I like to build capacity to maintain someone's speed and power through that process is to use a polarized training model, which means you do a lot of really easy stuff for long periods of time, and you do some really, really hard stuff for very short periods of time, and you do almost nothing in the middle. So that's like the moderately hard stuff for moderate amounts of time. You can get specific, and they would, the typical polarized model for more endurance athletes involves a lot of the zone one training, so the really easy stuff, and then like a relatively smaller amount, it's always going to be smaller, but a smaller amount of the high intensity stuff. And then technically an inverse polarized model would just have that flipped. So you spend like more time with the very high intensity stuff, but lots of like more time overall, but it's like short bursts with lots of rest in between, and then relatively less of the easy zone one and still very little time in zone two. And especially for endurance athletes, and can happen with a lot of fighters too, but you have this mentality to work hard all the time. And that if your effort is always 100%, that doesn't mean you're like, your output is always 100%. And for sure it's not going to be. So if you try hard all the time in every session, it feels like you're always going as hard as you can, but your output relative to like what you could do if you were fully rested starts dropping off more and more. And so rather than it being like a true maximal effort of 100%, you trying as hard as you can is like starts to be like 80% of your rested maximum. And again, that try hard strategy mean all the time, like your hard stuff's not as hard as it could be because you're not rested. And then you don't get the rest doing easy stuff because you're pushing harder than you should. And then all your training kind of gravitates to the middle. And so sometimes people do that by accident. They're like supposed to be following a more polarized model, but they're not really following the program. They're just like, think more is better and try as hard as they can, and everything ends up being in the middle. Other times it's more by design, where some coaches like a lot of that training, and that would be more of a threshold model, and specifically trying to get at some of those enzymes that will help to adapt to that type of training. There might be a place for including like a block of that in the scheme of things, but that that wouldn't be something I would go after often. And just to like recap, because we went off on some tangents there, but my like training wise, my two favorite options would be like do lots of easy aerobic work, like very easy work, so that you build a good aerobic system that provides a lot of energy. It means you're less likely to get there, but also means that you clear it faster when you do get there. The other strategy was just being very energy efficient and technically sound, so that you're less likely to get there. And then there's a role for strength in that as well. Because the stronger you are, any other effort is going to be relatively easier, which means like you're not, if it's 60% of your max, you're spending less energy than if it's 80% of your max. So there's definitely still a role of just being like strong all around. So we talked about two strategies there, like reducing power that we want to avoid, increasing efficiency, which is a great way. And then the third one would be to increase the amount of energy we have available. And that could be, again, for the car analogy, that would be like putting a bigger fuel tank on it or just refueling more often. For our human, that could be putting a bigger fuel tank on it. You can think of your muscles as literally a huge battery, like that stores energy in the form of glycogen and creatine. And so literally having bigger muscles means you store more energy within your muscles, and that represents a bigger work capacity. Whether that's advantageous to you depends on what exactly it is you're doing. Like if you're running, maybe not necessarily because you have a bigger tank, but now you also have the weight of that tank that you have to come around or carry around. If you're a lifter, like within your weight class, that may or may not be a good thing. Probably the less you have to worry about carrying your own body weight around, the more of an advantage it is just to have bigger muscles. The increasing the energy availability could include that better aerobic system we talked about. And it could just mean like how you're eating as well, and eating regularly versus say fasting or something like that. We talked a little bit about polarized training, a bit about mechanics and efficiency. One of my other favorite strategies, and you could apply this to like, I'll describe it in terms of lifting, but it could be applied to any type of training, but doing clusters of work or cluster sets. So rather than doing like one set of six, you do two sets of three with a short rest in between, or instead of one set of 12, you're doing four sets of three with short rests in between. And again, instead of like in the context of workout, instead of squatting three sets of 12, if I do three clusters of four sets of three, and within the cluster you have like a fairly short rest period that might be 30 or 45 seconds between each set, and then once you're done that 12, you take a much longer rest. That could be anywhere from like 4 to 10 minutes, depending on what load you're doing and how fit you are. But on paper, you've done exactly the same number of reps, but you've probably done it in similar time frames, maybe slightly longer with the cluster, but you generate less total fatigue when you've done the clusters. Your body's experienced kind of less scarcity through that, but it also lets you use a greater relative load than you would otherwise. So you could probably, if you were squatting 100 kilos for 12 reps, just in one go, maybe you can do 110 or 115 for the four sets of three with short rest in between. And so you can push your adaptations further that way. And you can, again, like if you're working on any, whether that's like running or biking or lifting, or you're on the mat, you can just take any work interval that you would normally do and just chop it up more. And have like, and again, rather than one round of 5 minutes and then a big rest, could be 5 1-minute rounds with short rests and then a big rest. The other big sort of training strategy I like is playing around with density. And so more commonly, like you'd hear this as escalating density training, but density refers to like the amount of work you get done in a certain amount of time. And the most common way that you see this applied is you would have a fixed time frame, and you would, each time you did that workout, you'd try to increase how much work you did within that time frame. So maybe it's a 20-minute time frame. You're doing cleans or snatches, some sort of skill on the mat. Maybe the first time, and if you're lifting, you get, say, like 30 total reps. And the next time you go to do that, you have, in that same 20 minutes, you get 40 total reps. That's a good strategy. If you have like a certain amount of time to train, and you just need to fit a workout within that, and then it gives a fairly easy way to track whether you're making progress on how much volume you're doing within that time frame. And probably for a certain block, you know, so that you would use the same load if we're talking about weights. And that could be on a 2-3-4 week kind of interval that you decide to change the load if you need to. But there still has to be some thought given to how you structure that, because you would still want to pace that in sort of more of that clustered way that I talked about, and not just do like AMRAP after AMRAP, try to crush out 20 in one set and then wait the shortest amount of time that you could and then crush out another AMRAP and just destroy yourself that way. I would use more reasonable work rest intervals. The other way you could structure the escalating density training is to do a fixed amount of work and gradually decrease the amount of time that you do that in. So an example would be if you did 4 sets of 10 of something, maybe the first time you do it with 3 minute rest periods. The second time you do it with 2 minute rest periods, and then maybe it's 90 seconds and then 60 seconds of rest. And then you reevaluate your load or whatever you're doing after that. So that's another nice way to go about it. And then the key kind of theme here is like keep rest in as much as possible, even if it's just a short recovery, and try to avoid like getting into those. The more, if you want to maintain your power, the more you can stay in the shorter energy systems, the better.
So there's two questions that I have. What would a polarizing strategy look like in a 7-day period? So for instance, like, would you have 4 of those days consecutively being light and then have like 3 of those days being very, very heavy? Or would you have that split up throughout the week in some way?
Yeah, it would depend on where the individual is at and what they're doing, but I would, and say we, and this is easier with like a runner, where like for an endurance athlete, where they're typically, they may not do much strength or other kind of work, say just running is the only thing they're doing. If you use the typical 3-zone model, then maybe like zone 1 is anything under 80% of their max heart rate. Zone 2 is 80 to 90. And then 3's above 90%. If they were just doing that, you could say, well, I'm going to do like 80% of my running mileage in zone 1. And then maybe you have like one really long run on the weekend and then 2 more moderate runs, and then you have a day where you're doing like tempos or speed intervals. It gets a little bit messy when we start including other modes of training, because you think like, how do I, if I was basing those zones on heart rate, like what do I classify a strength session as? Do I just always call a strength session a hard high intensity session, and then what if you're dividing your strength up into like strength days, hypertrophy, and maybe a speed power day, if it's kind of that, that model of training. I don't really have the answer to that. I would typically call it more of a harder day, the strength training. And then from there, again, it's not a set answer, but knowing yourself and knowing the athlete, like how many hard days a week can you handle? If someone is just strength training, like if they're just a powerlifter, a weightlifter, you know, maybe there's not much different between the sessions. They're all kind of hard days. And then in that model, you just start someone off who's more of a newbie on like 3 days a week. And if their schedule permits over time, you just progress them to like 4 days a week or 5 days a week if you think they need that to progress. But if you're doing a mix of strength training and running, strength training and fighting, then you also have to consider, does what I'm doing in the weight room affect what I'm going to do them on the mat or at the track. And say for a typical sprinter, like most short sprinters are not going to run like they might have one sort of max intensity day where they're running as fast as they can, one tempo day. That's more their kind of capacity day. And then later, early in the season, their third day might be a strength session. Later in the season, that might be like just an easy day, recovery day. Maybe there's some speed power stuff in the weight room there. But yeah, if you know that like a hard strength session is going to mess you up for 2 or 3 days after, well, then you have to like consider what kind of work you're doing in those 2 or 3 days. And so it's just too messy to give like any like real cookie cutter answer to that. But you could broadly describe more like technically oriented days in sport training as easy days. And then maybe most people might have like one really hard sport oriented day with more of a speed focus or more of a capacity focus. Maybe there's, for a fighter, there's another capacity day. And then one hard kind of strength day. Mm-hmm. And then as needed for capacity, you could just fill in like the easy aerobic work on every other day. And that kind of fits in as recovery as well. But, you know, for someone who's large and unfit to begin with, like literally walking may be enough to count as those like easy zone one training to get the heart rate elevated. And or maybe it's like if you have access, a nice hike somewhere. But then as someone gets fitter, that might be not enough of a stimulus anymore, and you might need like a slightly harder bike or run to really get your heart rate elevated and to get those kind of adaptations.
What are some things that you pay attention to whenever you are trying to decide whether or not you're stepping over into the sympathetic state?
Well, if you have tools where you can monitor heart rate, then resting heart rate can be one. And again, this can be depending on who you ask and depending on the person, it might be different directions. But for an endurance trained athlete who's very fit and typically has a low heart rate, when they're starting to get more sympathetic and overtrained, that stress response may start to elevate their heart rate above normal. Like if you talk to a relatively untrained individual, like in the pro metabolic community, whose goal is to have a higher resting heart rate, their sign of stressing it too much might be that heart rate starts to drop more than normal. You can also look at, again, if you have the tools, heart rate variability. Like that should typically be measured when or you get your baseline when you're well rested, and then deviations outside of your normal range would start to be a red flag there. Otherwise, you could look at mood, temperature, like the easy ones, like I guess, but slightly more subjective. Sleep quality is another big one. Mm-hmm. I'm like personally don't take the time to track most of those on the day-to-day. But if I were trying to pursue something at a higher level, then maybe I would. But.
So say that you have a client that's coming to you that's already in the sympathetic state. What would you do to kind of backtrack and help them get back into the parasympathetic state?
That would depend slightly on knowing the client and whether they're typically just always in a little bit more of that anxious or fight or flight kind of mode. But that may, like, most of the time people don't want to reduce their training volume. Training volume reduction could be one. It could be probably a better strategy is still to keep people busy, but to shift the type of work that they're doing. And if that individual hasn't been doing it already, probably some kind of breath work is going to help them get back into more of that parasympathetic state. And you know, depending on the client and what they're coming to me with, like if someone has a big injury history, they seem to be more stressed and their body's just more restricted in general. I may spend a lot of time at the outset doing breath related work. If I'm the better I can improve the quality of their breathing, then really without doing any mobility work, I can get their system to start loosening up and just make it more likely over the long run that they don't hurt themselves, but and that they feel better. But if someone comes to me and they move relatively well and they're not overly stressed, you know, generally just to be time efficient, I may like not do very much breath work at all with them. And it still may be a gap, but it's just not going to be like the biggest priority. But then if they get to that point where they're starting to be more stressed, and that's a time where I'd want to revisit that and just spend a little bit more time with it. And then I've been paying attention to the nutrition as well. Making sure they're eating enough, like getting enough salt. They're not skipping meals too much or skipping carbohydrates too much, getting some sleep. And sometimes too, it just comes down to like, some people need to talk and just having someone to listen to them is gonna take their stress down. And again, that could be part of like a more chill session for that individual, is just doing like easier breathing and mobility work and talking about life. I mean, it seems simple, but it is helpful.
So as a side job, you're kind of a therapist as well?
Occasionally, additionally, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that's, you know, a lot of strength coaches as well. Like when you're in a sport setting, like often the coaches tend to be harder on the athletes and they need to be like to get a lot of that out of that individual, but it can be like a little bit of a good cop, bad cop situation. Not that you're like, not that you can be too lenient on them either if you're trying to get a high performance level out of someone, but I feel like the strength coach is kind of the cool uncle sometimes, or aunt. And then yeah, for other trainers, like still just sometimes the trainer's like the only person outside of someone's normal family or social circle where they get to just get some energy out and do that. So it is that.
Heck yeah.
And you know, it's going to say just as far as like improving movement efficiency and getting more for less, I think the breathing can be another big factor. I see a lot of clients and individuals who come in with very poor posture and don't breathe very well. And there's a lot of things that can play into that. But like if someone tends to be in a more extended posture, chances are that they're not going to get a good expansion in their rib cage, at least on the posterior side, through an inhale. And then at the same time, they're often not able to get a full good exhale where they can really close the ribs down and get as much air out of their system as possible. And so they end up with more kind of residual volume or more air that's just hanging around in the lungs and not contributing as much. And so it seems really simple, but it sometimes just literally getting someone to breathe better, take fuller breaths, fuller inhales and exhales, and do that on a consistent basis can just improve their like VO2 for their activity without really doing any more endurance or capacity work. And you see, like, I would say a lot of the better physios and movement practitioners these days, you can see they have quite a big focus on breathing, or it's typically like in the basic work that they include. And it's something I was exposed to a long time ago, but just ignored earlier on because it just, I didn't see as much of an importance to it or benefit to it at the time. And I think one of the things that turned me around on that was like learning, one, having a few positive experiences for my own mobility, but then I think initially it was some concepts from PRI or the Postural Restoration Institute, where literally like a few seconds or a few minutes of a specific breathing drill would improve a swimmer's or an athlete's range of motion, their shoulder 30 degrees that they may have been trying to stretch in a more traditional sense for months and seen minimal to no progress. And so that was probably the start of it, but then I've just seen more and more benefits over the years. And then there's been some research on runners as well, and especially for longer distances, the fatigue of the respiratory muscles can be a limiting factor in performance. There's some tools where you can train to increase the strength of those specifically and breathing harder. And I haven't explored that too much, but maybe down the road. One thing I have started to play around with recently is doing some of that easy aerobic work with nasal breathing only. And I'd seen a couple articles on that, and it was a really interesting sensation. Whereas I'd say most people's default, like once their energy demand kicks up from activity, is just to start hyperventilating. So you get more oxygen into the system, but you're also blowing off more CO2. That means that through the Bohr effect, you're getting, you're actually making it harder for oxygen to get into your muscles, even though you're getting more oxygen into the system. And then that can contribute to that stress response and contribute to someone having a more kind of glycolytic metabolism where they bump into that lactic acid more easily. And forcing myself to only do the nasal breathing where that airflow is limited, it's very challenging to hyperventilate with that. And so it really, to get more air, it forces you to take sort of deep, full breaths. And it was a completely different feeling. And it's still early on for me for that, but that's something I think is probably worthwhile exploring a little bit more as a lower stress way of breathing during like easy moderate kind of aerobic activity, and maybe getting a little bit more or different training or different stimulus for the respiratory muscles in that process.
Definitely. I want to apologize. I was turning the AC off and I flipped it all the way up to heat and I started sitting here just pouring sweat. So
yeah,
I apologize for turning that off.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah.
So have you experimented with any kind of like eating frequency or different kinds of nutritional strategies that you typically like to stick to whenever you're trying to focus on recovery and increasing your ability to work more effectively?
I'd say my eating doesn't change that much from normal. So I typically eat 4 meals a day and snacks because that's just what's convenient for me. I typically eat a lot of carbs and then I just eat more carbs when I train more. And I don't really change protein or fat that much. I do think there's some for capacity, like probably two of the better studied ones would be like supplement wise would be baking soda and beta alanine I probably take most of the time, but the baking soda I wouldn't do unless there was like a specific workout or as training, maybe overall for more capacity. But there has been like some people avoid the baking soda because it upsets their stomach.
I was about to say, yeah, I know a couple people who have had some bad experiences with a little too much baking soda.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a similar story with, this is less common, but sodium citrate is another buffer sometimes used. But it's the way most researched use baking soda in the past and the way a lot of people try supplementing it for performance is just taking like one big dose an hour, a few hours before their event. I'd say that's the riskiest strategy as far as upsetting your GI. But there's been some more research over the years of using smaller amounts more regularly and doing it like in the days leading up to the event, not necessarily even on the day, and seeing the similar benefits to that. So like I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but you can measure your blood bicarbonate status. And then I think there was a meta-analysis where of the studies that measured that once you had an increase above a specific amount, that was sort of, there was sort of a threshold you needed to increase above your baseline and to get a performance enhancing effect. And you could do that with one bolus dose, one large dose at a time, with the risks associated with that. And a common dose of sodium bicarbonate is, I think it's 0.3 grams per kilo of body weight. And again, that would normally be in one sitting. But so some of this research looks at that same dose, but split into three, and taken 3 days leading into the event, if it was for competition. But so instead of 0.3 grams per kilo all at once, it's 0.1 grams per kilo three times a day for the 3 days prior. And then you can see the similar changes in the blood bicarbonate levels as you would as just taking one larger dose, and then with less risk of that upsetting your stomach. And sometimes you can even like the fact that you split it up like that, let someone use more than they normally would. So then maybe it's like some of the research would use 0.4 grams per kilo split up into three less. Sometimes they would use 0.5, but still probably getting on the high end. But I think that's an interesting one where, yeah, if you do it well and you test it out before you're doing something important, then that can be one to use. And then the beta alanine has a lot of interesting properties, and I definitely think it's underrated. But people typically only think of it as something that helps to buffer lactic acid. And so they say it's only useful for sort of events that are lasting between 2 to 4 minutes, where you have more of that lactic acid buildup. And that's where most of the research is done around, with less benefits shown for shorter durations or longer durations. But most of those are short-term studies. And the interesting thing about beta-alanine, one, beta-alanine is the precursor to the actual buffer, which is carnosine. Not to be confused with carnitine. But there's a group out of Europe where they were looking for ways to quantify what percentage fast twitch muscle fibers someone has. Normally you would have to do a biopsy for that. So stick a giant needle in someone's leg, take a chunk of their muscle out, stain it, and then you would see how much like fast, intermediate, and slow muscle someone have. And the greater proportion for those that don't know, like fast muscle contracts faster, the greater proportion of it that you have, the more powerful you should be. So they were looking for non-invasive ways to do that. So they did biopsies on a lot of athletes, and at the same time did a fancy MRI technique where you can look at different metabolites in the muscle. The one thing that stood out was that those who had more fast twitch muscles had much higher level of carnosine in their muscles. And so that doesn't necessarily tell you if taking beta alanine is going to make you faster or your muscles more fast twitch. It just means all you can really say from that is that if someone has more fast twitch muscles, they probably have more carnosine, the kind of a chicken and the egg thing. But I think looking at the research as a whole, there's some properties of that that mean if you're doing capacity-based training, you're probably less likely to turn your fast twitch muscles into slower twitch muscles. And so that's something that typically happens just with training in general. So in the fastest muscles in humans, they would call them 2X fibers. And then 2A is kind of the slightly slower ones. And then type 1 is the slow ones. And in research, almost any kind of training starts to turn the fast ones to the intermediate ones, 2X to 2A. And so that's part of the, another side, but part of the rationale for a good taper before competition, if you're a speed power athlete, where like, it's almost no matter what training you do, your muscles, you build your capacity, but you also get slower in that process. And then the thinking is if you have a good taper and a good rest before competition, that lets some of those fast twitch muscles come back. Either way, like there's really no research that says yes yet, but I think there's some mechanisms that would suggest that if you have good stores of beta-alanine or carnosine, you're probably less likely to see those fast to slower conversions and just maintain your speed more overall. The way most people use beta alanine is to have like 2 to 12 week kind of loading blocks, and then they would just stop taking it. And it's maintained a lot longer than in the muscle than creatine is. So creatine kind of washes out in a week if you stop using it. Beta alanine is probably there just as long as you were taking it for, say, and probably even longer. So like if you supplemented it for 12 weeks, your levels will probably be elevated above baseline for like 12 to 16 weeks after that. Mm-hmm. Although the more you, and the harder you train, the probably the faster that will go down. But that's the way most people use it. And there's some research to suggest that to get to the highest levels achievable in the muscle, it probably takes closer to a year of taking beta alanine to actually reach that full saturation. So there's probably very few individuals and athletes that really maximize that one right now.
What dose is that at?
So the typical research doses are anywhere from 3 to 12 grams a day, sometimes as low as 1.5, although 1.5 is really, it's like more of a maintenance dose. The more you take, the faster it will accumulate typically, but the more you take, the more likely you are to get the negative sensory effects, which they call it, it's paresthesia, but it means you get like a tingling and numbing sensation in your body, sometimes like a slight burning sensation in the skin that'll last 20 or 30 minutes. And for some people, that's way more intense than others. So I've typically only got it like if I took the higher end of that, but I've known some athletes who can't even tolerate like the 3 grams. They can eat like 1.5 grams with a meal and it's still uncomfortable but like tolerable at that point, but they just can't do any more. I have some other suspicions around that are untested that might relate to like vitamin B6 levels or some other things as to why some people get that more than others. But if you're taking larger doses, the more you spread that out, the more efficient the absorption will be. So aside from like 12 grams being super uncomfortable, you would probably absorb and retain more of it if you did 3 grams 4 times a day than if you did 1 times 12 grams. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really much of a difference in the rate of accumulation between 6 and 12 grams. It was there, but it was fairly marginal. So like 6 grams would be probably like a good place to be for most people if they wanted to accumulate that quickly in a cost efficient way.
Mm-hmm. Do you use any kind of like collagen supplementation or gelatin or anything like that?
I don't, like my stomach doesn't like collagen proteins, at least the powders, I mean, but I do okay with just plain gelatin sometimes. I don't make that often, but sometimes I'll make Jell-O that's just literally like regular gelatin powder and some kind of fruit juice. Sometimes in the winter when I'm making more bone broths, I'll just add extra gelatin to those. And I do take glycine more regularly. And sometimes I'll mix proline in there, but it's only like, there's only like one specific place where I order that from. So it's, if I happen to order from something from there, sometimes I'll get proline with it. Otherwise I just take some glycine.
Okay.
But yeah, I do take a larger dose of glycine before bed. And then if I'm around the house, then I might take like 5 grams with any meal that I eat. But then if I'm out of the house, I don't really bother with it other times of the day.
Where do you usually order your glycine from?
The glycine, I just use stuff from the local store. So that's either a brand called AOR or a brand called CanPrev. I don't think there's any, they seem like higher quality brands. I don't think there's anything special about them. I've tried ordering some like bulk supplements from some of the bulk supplement places online in the past, and the quality has never like impressed me too much. Like I've had some things that had an off smell to them, or like they were just way clumpier than a product I got locally. So I haven't found a great one in bulk yet.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I do work for a supplement company, so if you'd if you'd like an inside source, just let me know.
Yeah, we'll chat after.
So you went over the three strategies of better technique, increasing the reserves that you have, and then decreasing the amount of output, energy output, correct?
Yeah.
So how would somebody take those three strategies and use all three of them to their advantage simultaneously, if that's possible?
Yeah, well, again, the first strategy like is not one that I recommend. Typically the like reducing your energy output, depending what way you go about that. But like my goal is to maintain power as much as possible while I increase capacity. So I don't want my capacity to increase because I'm slower. I want to maintain my speed and just be able to do more at that speed. One thing that would be a safe thing that falls into that category would be just minimizing your energy expenditure outside of the training that's meaningful to you. So I think there's like a joke among sprinters that's like, don't stand if you can sit, don't sit if you can lie down, and don't just lie down if you can sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true, like everyone, like even when you do things to the best of your ability, there's still a limit to your energy reserves and availability. So if you have one goal that you're going after, put your energy towards that and then don't try to do a million other things. So just like in your spare time, do things that are relaxing to you and don't cost a lot of energy. So that would be something that falls into that category. That's not gonna, just a behavioral thing that allows you to increase your work capacity in the things that matter without actually like making you a slower person. And the other two, like technique, is just really understanding or working with someone who understands biomechanics well and actually like troubleshooting the movements you're trying to do and using your brain as much as you do just just as much as you might smash things normally. So if you were sparring with someone, like you could just spar and like freewheel it, and you would still learn lots of things in that process, and there's a need for that, but it would probably be more efficient if you had like a technique that you wanted to learn. Like you make a plan about how you're going to develop that skill. You like practice it in a controlled setting first and make sure you can nail it there, and then you put it into more like a less controlled scenario and see if you can integrate that skill there, rather than just doing whatever.
Do you have any tips for more quickly learning technique? So is there like a sequence that you found of learning a specific technique that tends to allow people to learn it more quickly?
One, I would say like, yes, spend the time to like think about it. I'd say watch videos of other people performing that skill successfully or at a high level, and monkey see, monkey do, but watch other people do it well and see what you can learn from that, and in slow motion. And then when you, this depends what you're trying to do, but don't just practice the same way of doing something. Like see how you can see how you can perturb it or like challenge it or put different constraints on it, like, and so, and I'll give like a more of a weight room example, but if someone's doing like a split squat and I'm just being very particular about the technique I want in it, there might be like a specific tension that I want more overall, like say in their front leg, I want some outward tension so that they kind of feel tension in their IT band or the outside of their leg. So I could have them just do a split squat and then tell them to push their knee outward so they get some of that. I can put a band that pulls their knee inwards so that they always have to keep that outward tension while they do it. But then I also may do that same, like once they know what the right split squats look like, maybe I'll have like a band that pulls their knee outward and then they need to pull it inward the right amount, or have like, I'd rather do 5 different variations of one thing, 5 slight variations, than do the same thing for 5 sets. Because even though they'll like, may not progress in like the one ideal form quite as quickly within that session, they're going to be, that pattern will become more resilient because they know how to create the shape that I want when it's disturbed in a bunch of different ways. And so that's kind of a weight room example, but like you could set up different track or like different sparring drills with like maybe there's a skill you want to execute, but you're like start from 5 different positions or with your opponent in different positions relative to you. And then you have to like figure out how to execute it rather than just doing like they're on you in the same like ideal way each time.
Are there certain things that you use to bring awareness to what the person's doing wrong and making them intentional about it. So you mentioned like wrapping a band around the knee to initiate a certain movement. Is there certain things that you do to make the mental connection for them too?
Well, I think like that helps make the mental connection sometimes, because I can tell them a bunch of things, and people have experience in kinesthetic awareness, or I've just been working with them for a while, like they'll know what I mean, but sometimes you just need to see it or feel it. And so like, first, yeah, I would use like, I would try to set up tension in an exercise that facilitates the position that I want. So it's like, or I guess I wouldn't say I do that in that order all the time, but you can use a tension that facilitates the position. So it's actually easier for them to do it than normal. And then you can also use tension that makes it harder for them to achieve the correct position. So that's a way you could categorize it. And then I'll use analogies often, like I'll, and it depends on the person's history, but trying to find ways to connect with that person so that they just have a better way to visualize it. And an example of that is like, you know, if someone's trying to tilt their hips forward, and do like, think like RDL deadlift type movement, where their butt stays high. Normally it's your backside that resists gravity in that position. So a lot of people use the muscles in their back to like pull their hips into the right position. And I can say that if someone's in a seated position in a chair, the normal tension that would feel is if I'm behind them and I'm pushing their back forward and they're resisting me, that's going to light up their back muscles and be like similar to the tension that they normally feel. But maybe for a particular drill, I want them to think about pulling themselves into position from the front side. And some people will get that right away. But then maybe I give them the opposite analogy of, okay, now you're still seated. I'm standing in front of you and I'm pushing you backwards on your collarbones. You're still trying to get to the same position, but now you actually have to like pull yourself there from your hip flexors and your core. So like same position, getting there two different ways, similar or different, and just trying to find like whatever analogy or scenario connects with the person based on their experience. And it's like us talking about car analogies as well, because it's really easy to like get lost in some of the details of biochemistry and go too far into that and lose people. But you know, when you're like, okay, two cars, set amount of gas, like big engine, small engine, small one lasts longer, big engine doesn't last as long but goes faster, it's easier that way. So those are the strategies I'll use, and just evaluating their reaction, and even if they get it sometimes, I'll still like mix up the analogies to make it stronger, I think. And there's research on that. I think some of the original stuff was on basketball in phys ed students, but like getting some students to only practice a single skill, like their like 3-point shot, and then getting the other students to take the same amount of training time but practice like 6 different skills on the court, and then the people doing only the one skill learn that one thing faster. But then if everyone takes their 4 months of summer off, and then you retest them at the end of it. The people that actually practiced like the bigger variety retain their skills better. And that was another thing I was going to say, was that just always trying to bring things back to the principles. And so if someone has very minimal experience with movement, then even watching a video in slow motion, it can be very abstract to like think how to get your own body to do that sometimes. Or you look at it and you're like, oh yeah, I can do that. And then you try and you're way off from their reality. But the more you spend on the basics of like learning how to tension your body in different ways and leverage different things, the more you'll be able to start to watch videos and skills you haven't done before and just start to pick that up. And so that's a big part of that technique and efficiency, is like not just learning a skill in fighting or learning like a hurdle drill or a drill on the track, but just learning how to move in general and spending the time to do that and to practice different things will end up going a lot further down the road. And I think one downfall with that is, you know, a lot of, it's changing, but a lot of the way that people train in the weight room, when you're like, you're mostly using dumbbells and barbells and all the resistance is downward against gravity, and you're mostly just, for most things, like standing in one place and not really moving forwards or backwards or side to side. It's just kind of upwards and downwards. That's the pressure you get used to applying, and that you understand applying, is just up and down. But that's quite a bit different than the pressure your foot and your body's applying to the ground in most sports, where you're moving, and so you need to not just like apply downward pressure to the ground, but you need to pull the ground in a certain direction in order to move your body around. And once you know those principles, it's simple. And then you can do it in the weight room and do it wherever. But again, if it's often where people just, they don't have athletic backgrounds. They're just kind of recreational athletes, and they've done stuff in the gym, typical stuff in the gym to gain size. They don't realize that. And so they try to apply force in the way that they're used to. And then that has certain consequences for the body, which usually, not always, but usually results in things being kind of more quad dominant and and more appropriate for that context, moving, creating vertical forces.
Yeah, it's interesting. So in most cases, what would you say you typically recommend? What planes of movement do you typically recommend moving in the most?
I don't even really like think about it in those terms anymore. Like I still like, when communicating it sometimes, I'll talk about the planes. Sagittal is the typical like up, down, forward, back. Frontal is kind of the side to side, and then transverse is the more rotational stuff. But any movement in sport involves all three planes at once. And that's what really stabilizes your body, is like, even when you're executing a typical weight room movement, say just like a split squat, again, if you don't just try to move up and down, but you create a torque in your body in the right direction, then that'll help to load the right tissues and make that still like overall an up and down movement, but just having that torque there is going to make it more applicable to moving in everyday life, you know, functional.
Definitely.
Give away the cheat code here, but usually like rotating towards your lead leg is what you want to think about.
Okay. Yeah. That actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And like even this, I'll end up going into more of a rant now, but when someone does a split squat, typically like, and the focus is on weight too much, they've been told to like keep their torso upright. And so they end up with this like upright torso that's kind of directly in the middle of their 2 feet. So they end up with a 50-50 weight distribution, and it's not a single leg exercise anymore. It's just a two-legged exercise and a split stance. And then that's not at all like how you load yourself in a lunge when you're actually moving your body forwards. It would be a very efficient pattern to like try to do that. It would be a good way to move something up and down and not do anything else with your body.
Well, I can sit here and ask you questions all day. I want to be very respectful of your time though. So where can people find you on social media, website, all of that good stuff?
Yeah, I'm mostly on Instagram these days. So my personal page where I just post random things of me working out and occasionally clients is at @NicholasSimpson_. And then there's a little bit more client and information related stuff at Vital Strength Physiology.
Awesome. Well, Nick, I appreciate you for hopping on here again, and look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for having me, and chat soon.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to hit the like button, subscribe, and leave a comment down below if you want us to cover a different topic.